Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences by Jacques Derrida, 1966. Perhaps something has occurred in the history of the concept of structure that could be called an event, if this loaded word did not entail a meaning which it is precisely the function of structural or structuralist thought to reduce or to suspect. But let me use the term event anyway, employing it with caution, and as if in quotation marks. In this sense, this event will have the exterior form of a rupture and a redoubling. It would be easy enough to show that the concept of structure and even the word structure itself are as old as the episteme. That is to say, as old as Western science and Western philosophy, and that their roots thrust deep into the soil of ordinary language, into whose deepest recesses the episteme plunges to gather them together once more, making them part of itself in a metaphorical displacement. Nevertheless, up until the event which I wish to mark out and define, structure, or rather the structurality of structure, although it has always been involved, has always been neutralized or reduced, and this by a process of giving it a center, or referring it to a point of presence, a fixed origin. The function of this unorganized structure, but above all, to make sure that the organizing principle of the structure would limit what we might call the free play of the structure. No doubt that by orienting and organizing the coherence of the system, the center of a structure permits the free play of its elements inside the total form. And even today, the notion of a structure lacking any center represents the unthinkable itself. Nevertheless, the center also closes off the free play it opens up and makes possible. Qua center, it is the point at which the substitution of contents, elements, or terms is no longer possible, and at the center, the permutation or the transformation of elements, which may, of course, be structures enclosed within a structure, is forbidden. At least this permutation has always remained interdicted. I use this word deliberately. Thus, it has always been thought that the center, which is by definition unique, constituted that very thing within a structure which governs the structure, while escaping structurality. This is why classical thought concerning structure could say that the center is, paradoxically, within the structure and outside it. The center is at the center of the totality, and yet, since the center does not belong to the totality, it is not part of the totality has its center elsewhere. The center is not the center. The concept of centered structure, although it represents coherence itself, the condition of the episteme, as philosophy or science, is contradictorily coherent. And, as always, coherence in contradiction expresses the force of a desire. The concept of centered structure is, in fact, the concept of a free play based on a fundamental ground, a free play which is constituted upon a fundamental immobility and a reassuring centeritude, which is itself beyond the reach of the free play. With this centeritude, anxiety can be mastered, for anxiety is invariably the result of a certain mode of being implicated in the game, of being caught by the game, of being, as it were, from the very beginning at stake in the game. From the basis of what we therefore call the center, and which, because it can be either inside or outside, is as readily called the origin as the end, as readily arche as telos. The repetitions, the substitutions, the transformations, and the permutations are always taken from a history of meaning, sins. That is, a history, period, whose origin may always be revealed, or whose end may always be anticipated in the form of presence. This is why one could perhaps say that the movement of any archaeology, like that of any eschatology, is an accomplice of this reduction of the structurality of structure and always attempts to conceive of structure from the basis of a full presence which is out of play. If this is so, the whole history of the concept of structure before the rupture I spoke of must be thought of as a series of substitutions of center for center, as a linked chain of determinations of the center. Successively and in a regulated fashion, the center receives different forms or names. The history of metaphysics, like the history of the West, is the history of these metaphors and metonymies. Its matrix, if you will pardon me for demonstrating so little and for being so elliptical in order to bring me more quickly to my principal theme, is the determination of being as a presence in all the senses of this word. It would be possible to show that all the names related to fundamentals, to principles, or to the center I have always designated the constant of a presence, eidos, arche, telos, energia, ousia, essence, existence, substance, subject, aletheia, truth, transcendentality, consciousness or conscience, God, man, and so forth. The event I called a rupture, the disruption alluded to at the beginning of this paper, would presumably have come about when the structurality of structure had to begin to be thought, that is to say, repeated. And this is why I said that this disruption was repetition in all the senses of this word. For then on it became necessary to think the law which governed, as it were, the desire for the center and the constitution of structure, and the process of signification prescribing its displacements and its substitutions for this law of the central presence, but a central presence which was never itself, which has always already been transported outside of itself in its surrogate. The surrogate does not substitute itself for anything which has somehow pre-existed it. From then on, it was probably necessary to begin to think that there was no center, that the center could not be thought in the form of a being present, that the center had no natural locus, that it was not a fixed locus, but a function, a sort of non-locus in which an infinite number of sign substitutions came into play. This moment was that in which language invaded the universal problematic, that in which, in the absence of a center or origin, everything became discourse, provided we can agree on this word, that is to say, when everything became a system where the central signified, the original or transcendental signified, is never absolutely present outside a system of differences. The absence of the transcendental signified extends the domain and the interplay of signification ad infinitum. Where and how does this decentering, this notion of the structurality of structure, occur? It would be somewhat naive to refer to an event, a doctrine, or an author in order to designate this occurrence. It is no doubt part of the totality of an era, our own, but still it has already begun to proclaim itself and begun to work. Nevertheless, if I wish to give some sort of indication by choosing one or two names, and by recalling those authors in whose discourses this occurrence has most nearly maintained its most radical formulation, I would probably cite the Nietzschean Critique of Metaphysics, the critique of the concepts of being and truth, for which were substituted the concepts of play, interpretation, and sign without truth present. The Freudian critique of self-presence, that is, the critique of consciousness, of the subject, of self-identity, and of self-proximity or self-possession, and, more radically, the Heideggerian destruction of metaphysics, of ontotheology, of the determination of being as presence. But all these destructive discourses and all their analogues are trapped in a sort of circle. This circle is unique. It describes the form of the relationship between the history of metaphysics and the destruction of the history of metaphysics. There is no sense in doing without the concepts of metaphysics in order to attack metaphysics. We have no language, no syntax, and no lexicon, which is alien to this history. We cannot utter a single destructive proposition which has not already slipped into the form, the logic, and the implicit postulations of precisely what it seeks to contest. To pick out one example from many, the metaphysics of presence is attacked with the help of the concept of the sign. But from the moment everyone wishes this to show, as I suggested a moment ago, that there is no transcendental or privilege signified, and that the domain or the interplay of signification has, henceforth, no limit, he ought to extend his refusal to the concept and to the word sign itself, which is precisely what cannot be done. For the signification sign has always been comprehended and determined in its sense as sign of signifier referring to a signified, signifier different from its signified. If one erases the radical difference between signifier and signified, it is the word signifier itself which ought to be abandoned as a metaphysical concept. When Levi Strauss says in the preface to The Raw and the Cooked that he has sought to transcend the opposition between the sensible and the intelligible by placing himself from the very beginning at the level of science, the necessity, the force, and the legitimacy of his act cannot make us forget that the concept of the sign cannot in itself surpass or bypass this opposition between the sensible and the intelligible. The concept of the sign is determined by this opposition. Through and throughout the totality of its history and by its system. But we cannot do without the concept of sign. We cannot give up this metaphysical complicity without also giving up the critique we are directing against this complicity, without the risk of erasing difference altogether in the self-identity of a signified reducing into itself its signifier, or what amounts to the same thing, simply expelling it outside itself. For there are two heterogeneous ways of erasing the difference between the signifier and the signified. One, the classic way, consists in reducing or deriving the signifier, that is to say, ultimately in submitting the sign to thought. The other, the one we are using here against the first one, consists in putting into question the system in which preceding reduction functioned. First and foremost, the opposition between the sensible and the intelligible. The paradox is that the metaphysical reduction of the sign needed the opposition it was reducing. The opposition is part of the system along with the reduction. And what I am saying here about the sign can be extended to all the concepts and all the sentences of metaphysics, in particular to the discourse on structure. But there are many ways of being caught in this circle. They are all more or less naive, more or less empirical, more or less systematic, more or less close to the formulation or even to the formalization of this circle. It is these differences which explain the multiplicity of destructive discourses and the disagreement between those who make them. It was within concepts inherited from metaphysics that Nietzsche, Freud, and Heidegger worked, for example. Since these concepts are not elements or atoms, and since they are taken from a syntax and a system, every particular borrowing drags along with it the whole of metaphysics. This is what allows these destroyers to destroy each other reciprocally. For example, Heidegger considered Nietzsche with as much lucidity and rigor as bad faith and misconstruction as the last metaphysician, the last Platonist. One could do the same for Heidegger himself, for Freud, or for a number of others, and today no exercise is more widespread. What is the relevance of this formal schema when we turn to what are called the human sciences? One of them perhaps occupies a privileged place, ethnology. One can, in fact, assume that ethnology could have been born as a science only at the moment when a decentering had come about. At the moment when European culture, and in consequence the history of metaphysics and of its concepts, had been dislocated, driven from its locus, and forced to stop considering itself as the culture of reference. This moment is not first and foremost a moment of philosophical or scientific discourse. It is also a moment which is political, economic, technical, and so forth. One can say in total assurance that there is nothing fortuitous about the fact that the critique of ethnocentrism, the very condition of ethnology, should be systematically and historically contemporaneous with the destruction of the history of metaphysics. Both belong to a single and same era. Ethnology, like any science, comes about within the element of discourse, and it is primarily a European science employing traditional concepts, however much it may struggle against them. Consequently, whether he wants to or not, and this does not depend on a decision on his part, the ethnologist accepts into his discourse the premises of ethnocentrism at the very moment when he is employed in denouncing them. This necessity is irreducible. It is not a historical contingency. We ought to consider very carefully all its implications. But if nobody can escape this necessity, and if no one is therefore responsible for giving into it, however little, this does not mean that all the ways of giving into it are of an equal pertinence. The quality and the fecundity of a discourse are perhaps measured by the critical rigor with which its relationship to the history of metaphysics and to inherited concepts is thought. Here it is a question of a critical relationship to the language of the human sciences and a question of a critical responsibility of the discourse. It is a question of putting expressly and systematically the problem of a discourse which borrows from a heritage the resources necessary of that heritage itself, a problem of economy and strategy. If I now go on to employ an examination of the texts of Levi Strauss as an example, it is not only because of the privilege accorded to ethnology among the human sciences, nor yet because the thought of Levi Strauss weighs heavily on the contemporary theoretical situation. It is above all because a certain choice has made itself evident in the work of Levi Strauss, and because a certain doctrine has been elaborated there, and precisely in a more or less explicit manner, in relation to this critique of language and to this critical language in the human sciences. In order to follow this movement in the text of Levi Strauss, let me choose as one guiding thread among others the opposition between nature and culture. In spite of all its rejuvenations and its disguises, this opposition is congenital to philosophy. It is even older than Plato. It is at least as old as the Sophists. Since the statement of the opposition, physis/nomos, physis/techne, or nature-culture, nature-art, or making, it has been passed on to us by a whole historical chain which opposes nature to the law, to education, to art, to techniques. Technics? And also to liberty, to the arbitrary, to history, to society, to structures of kinship. Levi Strauss has felt at one and the same time the necessity of utilizing this opposition and the impossibility of making it acceptable. In the elementary structures, he begins from this axiom or definition that belongs to nature, which is universal and spontaneous, not depending on any particular culture or on any determinate norm. That belongs to culture, on the other hand, which depends on a system of norms regulating society and is therefore capable of varying from one social structure to another. These two definitions are of the traditional type. But in the very first pages of the elementary structures, Levi Strauss, who has begun to give these concepts an acceptable standing, encounters what he calls a scandal. That is to say, something which no longer tolerates the nature/culture opposition he has accepted, and which seems to require at one and the same time the predicates of nature and those of culture. This scandal is the incest prohibition. The incest prohibition is universal. In this sense, one could call it natural, but it is also a prohibition, a system of norms and interdicts. In this sense, One could call it cultural. Let us assume, therefore, that everything universal in man derives from the order of nature and is characterized. By spontaneity, that everything which is subject to a norm belongs to culture and presents the attributes of the relative and the particular. We then find ourselves confronted by a fact, or rather an ensemble of facts, which in the light of the preceding definitions is not far from appearing as a scandal. The prohibition of incest presents without the least equivocation and indissolubly linked together the two characteristics in which we recognize the contradictory attributes of two exclusive orders. The prohibition of incest constitutes a rule, but a rule alone of all the social rules, which possesses at the same time a universal character. Obviously, there is no scandal except in the interior of a system of concepts sanctioning the difference between nature and culture. In beginning his work with the factum of the incest prohibition, Levi Strauss thus puts himself in a position entailing that the difference, which has always been assumed to be self-evident, becomes obliterated or disputed. For, from the moment that the incest prohibition can no longer be conceived within the nature-culture opposition, and can no longer be said that it is a scandalous fact, a nucleus of opacity within a network of transparent significations. The incest prohibition is no longer a scandal one meets with or comes up against in the domain of traditional concepts. It is the something which escapes these concepts, and certainly precedes them, probably as the condition of their possibility. It could perhaps be said that the whole of philosophical conceptualization, systematically relating itself to the nature-culture opposition, is designed to leave in the domain of the unthinkable the very thing that makes this conceptualization possible, the origin of the prohibition of incest. I have dealt too cursorily with this example, only one among so many others, but the example nevertheless reveals that language bears within itself the necessity of its own critique. This critique may be undertaken along two tracks, in two manners. Once the limit of nature/culture opposition makes itself felt, one might want to question systematically and rigorously the history of these concepts. This is a first action. Such a systematic and historic questioning would be neither a philological nor a philosophical action in the classic sense of these words. Concerning oneself with the founding concepts of the whole history of philosophy, deconstituting them, is not to undertake the task of the philologist or of the classic historian of philosophy. In spite of appearances, it is probably the most daring way of making the beginnings of a step outside of philosophy. The step outside of philosophy is much more difficult to conceive than is generally imagined by those who think they made it long ago with cavalier ease, and who are in general swallowed up in metaphysics by the whole body of the discourse that they claim to have disengaged from it. In order to avoid the possibly sterilizing effect of the first way, the other choice, which I feel corresponds more nearly to the way chosen by Levi Strauss, consists in conserving in the field of empirical discovery all these old concepts, while at the same time exposing here and there their limits, treating them as tools which can still be of use. No longer is any truth value attributed to them. There is a readiness to abandon them if necessary, if other instruments should appear more useful. In the meantime, their relative efficacy is exploited, and they are employed to destroy the old machinery to which they belong, and of which they themselves are pieces. Thus it is that the language of the human sciences criticizes itself. Levi Strauss thinks that in this way he can separate method from truth, the instruments of the method, and the objective significations aimed at by it. One could almost say that this is the primary affirmation of Levi Strauss. In any event, the first words of the elementary structures are, One begins to understand that the distinction between state of nature and state of society, we would be more apt to say today state of nature and state of culture, while lacking any acceptable historical signification, presents a value which fully justifies its use by modern sociology. Its value is as a methodological instrument. Levi Strauss will always remain faithful to this double intention, to preserve as an instrument that whose truth value he criticizes. On the one hand, he will continue, in effect, to contest the value of the nature-culture opposition. More than 13 years after The Elementary Structures, The Savage Mind faithfully echoes the text I have just quoted. The opposition between nature and culture, which I have previously insisted on, seems today to offer a value which is above all methodological. And this methodological value is not affected by its ontological non-value. As could be said, if this notion were not suspect here, it would not be enough to have absorbed particular humanities into a general humanity. This first enterprise prepares the way for others, which belong to the natural and exact sciences, to reintegrate culture into nature, and finally to reintegrate life into the totality of its physiochemical conditions. That was a quote. On the other hand, still in The Savage Mind, he presents as what he calls bricolage what might be called the discourse of this method. The bricoleur, says Levi Strauss, is someone who uses the means at hand, that is, the instruments he finds as his disposition around him, those which are already there, which had not been especially conceived with an eye to the operation for which they are to be used, and to which one tries by trial and error to adapt them, not hesitating to change them whenever it appears necessary, or to try several of them at once, even if their form and their origin are heterogeneous, and so forth. There is therefore a critique of language in the form of bricolage, and it has even been possible to say that bricolage is the critical language itself. I am thinking in particular of the article by Gerard Genet, Structuralism et Critique Littéraire, published in homage to Levi Strauss in a special issue of L'Arc, where it is stated that the analysis of bricolage could be applied almost word for word to criticism and especially to literary criticism. If one calls bricolage the necessity of borrowing one's concept from the text of a heritage which is more or less coherent or ruined, it must be said that every discourse is bricoleur. The engineer whom Levi Strauss opposes to the bricoleur should be one to construct the totality of his language, syntax, and lexicon. In this sense, the engineer is a myth, a subject who would supposedly be the obsolete origin of his own discourse and would supposedly construct it out of nothing, out of whole cloth, would be the creator of the verba itself. The notion of the engineer who has supposedly broken with all forms of bricolage is therefore a theological idea, and since Levi Strauss tells us elsewhere that bricolage is mythopoetic, the odds are that the engineer is a myth produced by the bricoleur. From the moment that we cease to believe in such an engineer and in a discourse breaking with the received historical discourse, as soon as it is admitted that every finite discourse is bound by a certain bricolage, and that the engineer and the scientist are also species of bricoleurs, then the very idea of bricolage is menaced, and the difference in which it took on its meaning decomposes. This brings out the second thread which might guide us in what is being unraveled here. Levi Strauss describes bricolage not only as an intellectual activity, but also as a mythopoetical activity. One reads in The Savage Mind, like bricolage on the technical level, mythical reflection can attain brilliant and unforeseen results on the intellectual level. Reciprocally, the mythopoetical character of bricolage has often been noted. But the remarkable endeavor of Levi Strauss is not simply to put forward, notably in the most recent of his investigations, a structural science or a knowledge of myths and of mythological activity. His endeavor also appears, I would say almost from the first, in the status which he accords to his own discourse on myths, to what he calls his mythologicals. It is here that his discourse on the myth reflects on itself and criticizes itself. And this moment, this critical period, is evidently of concern to all the languages which share the field of the human sciences. What does Levi Strauss say of his mythologicals? It is here that we discover the mythopoetical virtue, power, of bricolage. In effect, what appears most fascinating in this critical search for a new status of the discourse is the stated abandonment of all reference to a center, to a subject, to a privileged reference, to an origin, or to an absolute arche. The theme of this decentering could be followed throughout the overture to his last book, The Raw and the Cooked. I shall simply remark on a few key points. One, from the very start, Levi Strauss recognizes that the Barrow myth, which he employs in the book as the reference myth, does not merit this name and this treatment. The name is specious, and the use of the myth improper. This myth deserves no more than any other its referential privilege. In fact, the Barrow myth, which will from now on be designated by the name reference myth, is, as I shall try to show, nothing other than a more or less forced transformation of other myths originating either in the same society or in societies more or less far removed. It would therefore have been legitimate to choose as my point of departure any representative of the group whatsoever. From this point of view, the interest of the reference myth does not depend on its typical character, but rather on its irregular position in the midst of a group. Two, there is no unity or absolute source of the myth. The focus or the source of the myth are always shadows and virtualities, which are elusive, unactualizable, and non-existent in the first place. Everything begins with the structure, the configuration, the relationship. The discourse on this acentric structure, the myth that is, cannot itself have an absolute subject or an absolute center. In order not to shortchange the form and the movement of the myth, that violence which consists in centering a language which is describing an acentric structure must be avoided. In this context, therefore, it is necessary to forego scientific or philosophical discourse, to renounce the episteme, which absolutely requires, which is the absolute requirement, that we go back to the source, to the center, to the founding basis, to the principle, and so on. In opposition to epistemic discourse, structural discourse on myths, mythological discourse, must itself be mythomorphic. It must have the form of that of which it speaks. This is what Levi Strauss says in The Raw and the Cooked, from which I would now like to quote a long and remarkable passage. In effect, the study of myths poses a methodological problem by the fact that it cannot conform to the Cartesian principle of dividing the difficulty into as many parts as are necessary to resolve it. There exists no veritable end or term to mythical analysis, no secret unity which could be grasped at the end of the work of decomposition. The themes duplicate themselves to infinity. When we think we have disentangled them from each other and can hold them separate, it is only to realize that they are joining together again in response to the attraction of unforeseen affinities. In consequence, the unity of the myth is only tendential and projective. It never reflects a state or a moment of the myth. An imaginary phenomenon implied by the endeavor to interpret, its role is to give a synthetic form to the myth and to impede its dissolution into the confusion of contraries. It could therefore be said that the science or knowledge of myths is an anaclastic. Taking this ancient term in the widest sense authorized by its etymology, a science which admits into its definition the study of the reflected rays along with that of the broken ones. But unlike philosophical reflection, which claims to go all the way back to its source, the reflections in questions here concern rays without any other than a virtual focus. In wanting to imitate the spontaneous movement of mythical thought, my enterprise, itself too brief and too long, has had to yield to its demands and respect its rhythm. Thus is this book, on myths itself, and in its own way, a myth. This statement is repeated a little farther on, quote, "Since myths themselves rest on second-order codes, the first-order codes being those in which language consists, this book thus offers the rough draft of a third-order code, destined to ensure the reciprocal possibility of translation of several myths. This is why it would not be wrong to consider it a myth, the myth of mythology, as it were." End quote. It is by this absence of any real and fixed center of the mythical or mythological discourse that the musical model chosen by Levi Strauss for the composition of his book is apparently justified. The absence of a center is here the absence of a subject and the absence of an author. Quote, "The myth and the musical work thus appear as orchestra conductors whose listeners are the silent performers. If it be asked where the real focus of the work is to be found, it must be replied that its determination is impossible. Music and mythology bring man face to face with virtual objects whose shadow alone is actual. Myths have no authors." End quote. Thus it is at this point that ethnographic bricolage deliberately assumes its mythopoetic function. But by the same token, this function makes the philosophical or epistemological requirement of a center appear as mythological, that is to say, as a historical illusion. Nevertheless, even if one yields to the necessity of what Levi Strauss has done, one cannot ignore its risks. If the mythological is mythomorphic, are all discourses on myths equivalent? Shall we have to abandon any epistemological requirement which permits us to distinguish between several qualities of discourse on myth? A classic question, but inevitable. We cannot reply, and I do not believe Levi Strauss replies to it, as long as the problem of the relationships between the philosopheme, or the theorem, on the one hand, and the mytheme, or the mythopoem, on the other, has not been expressly posed. This is no small problem. For lack of expressly posing this problem, we condemn ourselves to transforming the claimed transgression of philosophy into an unperceived fault in the interior of the philosophical field. Empiricism would be the genus of which these faults would always be the species. Trans-philosophical concepts would be transformed into philosophical naivetés. One could give many examples to demonstrate this risk, the concepts of sign, history, truth, and so forth. What I want to emphasize is simply that the passage beyond philosophy does not consist in turning the page of philosophy, which usually comes down to philosophizing badly, but in continuing to read philosophers in a certain way. The risk I am speaking of is always assumed by Levi Strauss, and it is the very price of his endeavor. I have said that empiricism is the matrix of all the faults menacing a discourse which continues, as with Levi Strauss in particular, to elect to be scientific. If we wanted to pose the problem of empiricism and bricolage in depth, we would probably end up very quickly with a number of propositions absolutely contradictory in relation to the status of discourse in structural ethnography. On the one hand, structuralism justly claims to be the critique of empiricism. But at the same time, there is not a single book or study by Levi Strauss which does not offer itself as an empirical essay which can always be completed or invalidated by new information. The structural schemata are always proposed as hypotheses resulting from a finite quantity of information, and which are subjected to the proof of experience. Numerous texts could be used to demonstrate this double postulation. Let us turn once again to the overture of The Raw and the Cooked, where it seems clear that if this postulation is double, it is because it is a question here of a language on language. Quote, "Critics who might take me to task for not having begun by making an exhaustive inventory of South American myths before analyzing them would be making a serious mistake about the nature and the role of these documents. The totality of the myths of a people is of the order of the discourse. provided that this people does not become physically or morally extinct. This totality is never closed. Such a criticism would therefore be equivalent to reproaching a linguist with writing the grammar of a language without having recorded the totality of the words which have been uttered since that language came into existence, and without knowing the verbal exchanges which will take place as long as the language continues to exist. Experience proves that an absurdly small number of sentences allows the linguist to elaborate a grammar of the language he is studying. And even a partial grammar or an outline of grammar represents valuable acquisitions in the case of unknown languages. Syntax does not wait until it has been possible to enumerate a theoretically unlimited series of events before becoming manifest, because syntax consists in the body of rules which presides over the generation of these events. And it is precisely a syntax of South American mythology that I wanted to outline. Should new texts appear to enrich the mythical discourse, then this will provide an opportunity to check or modify the way in which certain grammatical laws have been formulated, an opportunity to discard certain of them, and an opportunity to discover new ones. But in no instance can the requirement of a total mythical discourse be raised as an objection, for we have just seen that such a requirement has no meaning. End quote. Totalization is therefore defined at one time as useless, at another time as impossible. It is no doubt the result of the fact that there are two ways of conceiving the limit of totalization. And I assert once again that these two determinations coexist implicitly in the discourses of Levi Strauss. Totalization can be judged impossible in the classical style. One then refers to the empirical endeavor of a subject or of a finite discourse in a vain and breathless conquest of an infinite richness which it can never master. There is too much, more than one can say. But non-totalization can also be determined in another way, not from the standpoint of the concept of finitude as assigning us to an empirical view, but from the standpoint of the concept of free play. If totalization no longer has any meaning, it is not because the infinity of a field cannot be covered by a finite glance or a finite discourse, but because the nature of the field, that is, language and a finite language, excludes totalization. This field is in fact that of free play. That is to say, a field of infinite substitutions in the closure of a finite ensemble. This field permits these infinite substitutions only because it is finite. That is to say, because instead of being an inexhaustible field, as in the classical hypothesis, instead of being too large, there is something missing from it, a center which arrests and founds the free play of substitutions. One could say, rigorously using that word whose scandalous signification is always obliterated in French, that is movement of the free play, permitted by the lack, the absence of a center or origin, is the movement of a supplementarity. One cannot determine the center, the sign which supplements it, which takes its place in its absence. Because this sign adds itself, occurs in addition, over and above, comes as a supplement. The movement of signification adds something, which results in the fact that there is always more. But this addition is a floating one, because it comes to perform a vicarious function, to supplement a lack on the part of the signified. Although Levi Strauss, in his use of the word supplementary, never emphasizes, as I am doing here, the two directions of meaning which are so strangely compounded within it. It is not by chance that he uses this word twice in his introduction to the work of Marcel Mauss. At the point where he is speaking of the superabundance of signifier in relation to the signifieds to which this superabundance can refer, quote, "In his endeavor to understand the world, man therefore always has at his disposition, a surplus of signification, which he portions out amongst things according to the laws of symbolic thought, which it is the task of ethnologists and linguists to study. The distribution of a supplementary allowance, ration supplementaire, if it is permissible to put it that way, is absolutely necessary in order that, on the whole, the available signifier and the signified it aims at may remain in the relationship of complementarity, which is the very condition of the use of symbolic thought. In parentheses, it could no doubt be demonstrated that this ration supplementaire of signification is the origin of the ratio itself. The word appears a little farther on after Levi Strauss's mention this floating signifier, which is the servitude of all finite thought. This is another block quote. In other words, and taking as our guide Mauss's percept that all social phenomena can be assimilated to language, we see in mana, wakao, oranda, and other notions of the same type the conscious expression of a semantic function whose role is to permit symbolic thought to operate in spite of the contradiction which is proper to it. In this way are explained the apparently insoluble antinomies attached to this notion. At one and the same time, force and action, quality and state, substantive and verb, abstract and concrete, omnipresent and localized, man's is in effect all these things. But it is not precisely because it is none of these things that mana is a simple form, or more exactly, a symbol in the pure state and therefore capable of becoming charged with any sort of symbolic content whatever. In the system of symbols constituted by all cosmologies, mana would simply be a zero symbolic value. That is to say, a sign marking the necessity of a symbolic content supplementary to that with which the signified is already loaded, but which can take on any value required, provided only that this value still remains part of the available reserve and is not, as phonologists put it, a group term. Levi Strauss adds the note, linguists have already been led to formulate hypotheses of this type. For example, a zero phoneme is opposed to all the other phonemes in French in that it entails no differential characters and no constant phonetic value. On the contrary, the proper function of the zero phoneme is to be opposed to phoneme absence. Similarly, if we schematize the conception I am proposing here, it could almost be said that the function of notions like mana is to be opposed to the absence of signification without entailing by itself any particular signification. The overabundance of the signifier, its supplementary character, is thus the result of a finitude, that is to say, the result of a lack which must be supplemented. It can now be understood why the concept of play is important in Levi Strauss. His references to all sorts of games, notably to roulette, are very frequent, especially in his conversations in race history and in the savage mind. Further, the reference to play is always caught up in tension. Tension with history, first of all. This is a classical problem, objections to which are now well worn. I shall simply indicate what seems to me the formality of the problem. By reducing history, Levi Strauss has treated as it deserves a concept which has always been in complicity with a teleological and eschatological metaphysics, in other words, paradoxically, in complicity with that philosophy of presence to which it was believed history could be opposed. The thematic of history, although it seems to be a somewhat late arrival in philosophy, has always been required by the determination of being as presence. With or without etymology, and despite the classic antagonism which opposes these significations throughout all of classical thought, it could be shown that the concept of episteme has always called forth that of historia. If history is always the unity of a becoming, as the tradition of truth or the development of science or knowledge oriented towards the appropriation of truth in presence and self-presence toward knowledge and consciousness of self. History has always been conceived as the movement of a resumption of history, as a detour between two presences. But if it is legitimate to suspect this concept of history, there is a risk. If it is reduced without an explicit statement of the problem I am indicating here, of falling back into an ahistoricism of a classical type, that is to say, into a determined moment of the history of metaphysics. Such is the algebraic formality of the problem as I see it. More concretely, in the work of Levi Strauss, it must be recognized that the respect for structurality, for the internal originality of the structure, compels a neutralization of time and history. For example, the appearance of a new structure, of an original system, always comes about, and this is the very condition of its structural specificity, by a rupture with its past, its origin, and its cause. Therefore, one can describe what is peculiar to the structural organizations only by not taking into account, in the very moment of this description, its past conditions. By omitting to posit the problem of the transition from one structure to another, by putting history between brackets. In this structureless moment, the concepts of chance and discontinuity are indispensable, and Levi Strauss does in fact often appeal to them, for example, as concerns that structure of structures, language, of which he says in the introduction to the work of Marcel Mauss, that it could only have been born in one fell swoop. This is another Bloch quote. Whatever may have been the moment and the circumstances of its appearance on the scale of animal life, language could only have been born in one fell swoop. Things could not have set about acquiring signification progressively, following a transformation the study of which is not the concern of the social sciences, but rather of biology and psychology. A transition came about from a stage where nothing had a meaning to another, where everything possessed it. End quote. This standpoint does not prevent Levi Strauss from recognizing the slowness, the process of maturing, the continuous toil of factual transformations, history, for example, race and history. But in accordance with a gesture which was also Rousseau's and Husserl's, he must set aside all the facts at the moment when he wishes to recapture the specificity of a structure. Like Rousseau, he must always conceive of the origin of a new structure on the model of catastrophe, an overturning of nature in nature, a natural interruption of the natural sequence, a setting aside of nature. Besides the tension between play and history, there is also the tension between play and presence. Play is the disruption of presence. The presence of an element is always a signifying and substitutive reference inscribed in a system of differences and the movement of a chain. Play is always play of absence and presence. But if it is to be thought radically, play must be conceived of before the alternative of presence and absence. Being must be conceived as presence or absence on the basis of the possibility of play and not the other way around. If Levi Strauss, better than any other, has brought to light the play of repetition and the repetition of play, one no less perceives in his work a sort of ethic of presence, an ethic of nostalgia for origins, an ethic of archaic and natural innocence, of purity of presence and self-presence in speech, an ethic, nostalgia, and even remorse which he often presents as the motivation of the ethnological project when he moves toward the archaic societies which are exemplary societies in his eyes. These texts are well known. Turn towards the lost or impossible presence of the absent origin. The structuralist thematic of broken immediacy is therefore the saddened, negative, nostalgic, guilty, Rousseauistic side of the thinking of play, whose other side would be the Nietzschean affirmation. That is the joyous affirmation of the play of the world and of the innocence of becoming, the affirmation of a world of signs without fault, without truth, and without origin, which is offered to an active interpretation. This affirmation then determines the non-center otherwise than as loss of the center. And it plays without security, for there is a sure play, that which is limited to the substitution of given and existing present pieces. In absolute chance, affirmation also surrenders itself to genetic indetermination, to the seminal adventure of the trace. There are thus two interpretations of interpretation, of structure, of sign, of play. The one seeks to decipher, dreams of deciphering, a truth or an origin which escapes play and the order of the sign, and which lives the necessity of interpretation as an exile. The other, which is no longer turned toward the origin, affirms play and tries to pass beyond man and humanism, the name of man being the name of that being who, throughout the history of metaphysics or of ontotheology, in other words, throughout his entire history, has dreamed of full presence, the reassuring foundation, the origin, and the end of play. The second interpretation of interpretation, to which Nietzsche pointed the way, does not seek in ethnography, as Levi Strauss does, the inspiration of a new humanism, again citing the introduction to the work of Marcel Mauss. There are more than enough indications today to suggest we might perceive that these two interpretations of interpretation, which are absolutely irreconcilable even if we live them simultaneously and reconcile them in an obscure economy, together share the field which we call, in such a problematic fashion, the social sciences. For my part, although these two interpretations must acknowledge and accentuate their difference and define their irreducibility, I do not believe that today there is any question of choosing. In the first place, because here we are in a region, let us say provisionally, a region of historicity, where the category of choices seems particularly trivial, and in the second, because we must first try to conceive of the common ground and the difference of the irreducible difference. Here there is a kind of question, let us still call it historical, whose conception, formulation, gestation, and labor we are only catching a glimpse of today. I employ these words, I admit, with a glance toward the operations of childbearing, but also with a glance towards those who, in a society from which I do not exclude myself, turn their eyes away when faced by the as-yet unnameable, which is proclaiming itself, and which can do so as is necessary whenever a birth is in the offing. Only under the species of the non-species, in the formless, mute infant, and terrifying form of monstrosity. I have no idea what the hell I just read.